We're gonna do 15. We're gonna do 15. They won.
Okay.
So we'll do 15.
Okay.
Okay, Council Harris.
May it please the court. This appeal should begin and end with this court's precedential 2020 opinion in Keohane. Keohane holds that a prison does not violate the Eighth Amendment by refusing to grant special access to clothing and cosmetics for an inmate with gender dysphoria. Our record shows the opposite of deliberate indifference. Plaintiff here has an individualized treatment plan for gender dysphoria that includes hormones, psychological care, female undergarments, and special security precautions such as the ability to shower alone. Yet the district court held that the Eighth Amendment requires even more clothing and grooming products.
Well, Keohane helps you a lot, but it doesn't stand for the proposition that you could never have an Eighth Amendment claim. I mean, Keohane was based on a certain record, and based on that record, the panel made certain legal determinations, right?
Yes, Your Honor, and I don't read it that way. And I think the two key pieces of Keohane are these items medically necessary, and then the security piece. And I think our case is actually easier than Keohane, because on medical necessity, we offered Dr. Stephen Levine, an esteemed psychiatrist in this area, who testified in Keohane, and the court credited his testimony. And on security, I don't need to recount it all, but this inmate, in addition to being in prison for violent sexual offenses, has an extensive record of crimes and misconduct in prison, including...
I think, you know, in support of your case, I think one of your strong arguments is that the district court just didn't adequately account for the affidavit of the warden on security concerns.
Right.
Now, I don't know what the district court could or could not have done in sort of weighing the evidence about the security concerns. There's this evidence about maybe the warden having allowed Doe to have used her own padding at some point for a limited period of time. I don't know. But I think the district court, at least given Keohane, had to confront the statement of the warden in the affidavit that this presented security and safety concerns.
Right, so a couple points on that. So Doe is in administrative segregation, which is not to be confused with solitary, which is for punishment. Administrative segregation is for individuals with difficult management issues, frankly, because of misconduct in prison. It's to protect the other prisoners from Doe.
And what works it works the same way physically, right?
Not entirely, but generally it's more segregation.
You're by yourself.
Yes, but the warden specifically says because Doe is in administrative segregation and has a history of escape attempts, we have to be very careful about these special items. And then on the question of the warden allowing it, my colleague, it's in the transcript where my colleague addressed this. So first of all, the warden had confiscated the padding at some points in the past, but I don't think not enforcing the rules for a limited time, even if that happens, can convert something into an Eighth Amendment violation.
Yeah, well, and the bigger problem to me, it seems, is just as a legal error, it appears that the district court thinks that the provision of sophisticated care for the treatment of the inmate's condition somehow mandates the provision of less sophisticated treatment that And not doing so somehow violates the Eighth Amendment. And I'm just lost about how that can be right as a matter of law.
And, Your Honor, it's actually more than that, because in Keohane, the court says at page 1276, this is not a denial of care situation. We are giving extensive care, just not doing everything the plaintiff wants. And so Keohane specifically says, in that situation where you're doing a lot but not everything, we're going to be super deferential on security concerns, because we're not saying we're not doing anything, forgot about that, we're not treating this. We're saying you can have this, and this.
Reasoning is, I read that order is, well, you're giving this more sophisticated care, so it's a violation of the Eighth Amendment not to give the less sophisticated care. Isn't that what the district court said?
Yes, well, and I think part of the confusion is over, so the district court said, I credit the plaintiff's experts on medical necessity, but there's a problem. They didn't use the Eighth Amendment definition of medical necessity. So they used, this is, it's Dr., let me see. It's Dr. Lowell, their experts report paragraph 24, and then they argued this to the district court that medical, they say medical necessity is anything that treats a condition, and specifically say it's not a high bar. That's the opposite of the standard. In Hoffer, Keohane, Ward, this court says in the Eighth Amendment, it's a steep hill to climb. It has to be so grossly incompetent, inadequate, or excessive as to shock the conscience. So I don't dispute that their experts said this is medically necessary. They were not using the Eighth Amendment definition.
I didn't mean to interrupt you. I'm sorry.
Or just to close the thought, essentially the insurance standard. So the sort of standard they used would be if you're trying to get something paid for by insurance, you would say, oh, it's medically necessary, so it's appropriate, it's indicated, that sort of thing. But their experts weren't applying the Eighth Amendment standard.
But don't our cases sort of deal with that scenario by saying if there's a difference in opinion as to medical necessity, then it's not deliberate indifference?
Absolutely. And again,
But they don't say there's no medical necessity. They just say a prison official can't act in a deliberately indifferent way under the Eighth Amendment if medical professionals differ in their opinions about whether or not a certain mode of treatment is needed. They don't talk about this is not medically necessary. They just say, and I'm not saying all of our cases, but some of our cases indicate that you take care of that scenario under the deliberate indifference prong by saying, if you have a difference of opinion by reason medical professionals, then the choice of prison officials for one over the other can't be deliberately indifferent.
I agree with that, Your Honor. And again, using the language that this court repeatedly uses, Keohane, Hoffer, Ward, so grossly incompetent or inadequate. And if there is a difference of opinion, I don't think you would say there's a zone of treatment where the Eighth Amendment simply doesn't dictate that you pick this over this. And on this question of necessity, again, what Levine, who testified in Kosolek, who testified in Keohane, several of the leading cases in this area, what Levine and Kalibe say is, everyone in prison wants something different in terms of their grooming. Everyone wants different grooming products, different cosmetics, different clothes, and that may be something the inmate wants. It may be something.
Let me ask you a question here. Did Levine actually examine the plaintiff in Keohane?
I know he did not hear. Well, so Levine and Kalibe. So first of all, Keohane was a trial on the merits, and we were a PI hearing, and so.
No, I understand that. I was just curious whether the psychiatrist in Keohane had actually examined the person seeking the care and the treatment.
So a couple things.
We have an opinion here. It doesn't mean the opinion is worth nothing. I'm just asking whether these psychiatric experts examined the plaintiff in the other case. I know they did not hear.
I'll check on that and report in rebuttal. I don't know off the top of my head, but a couple points on that, Your Honor. So there's no blanket rule that an expert can't testify if they didn't physically examine the plaintiff.
You need not argue that point. I understand that's true.
And let me make one other point about the plaintiff's experts.
There's some difference. For example, if you had a prisoner who was diabetic and you didn't give them insulin, an endocrinologist could give me an opinion worth its weight in gold without actually examining the inmate. On the other hand, when sometimes you're talking about psychiatric disorders, the capacity to speak directly might be relevant in determining the strength, the validity of the opinion being offered. And that's why I was simply asking, I'm correct that in this case, the psychiatric experts for the state did not actually examine Jane Doe.
Correct. Now, to be clear, it was a preliminary injunction on a very tight table.
Right.
And they did review medical records. I would also like to point out, the plaintiff's experts were not longtime treating physicians. The plaintiff's experts testified at the hearing. I believe they had met with the plaintiff for 60 minutes by Zoom, or so, which I'm not discounting, but it was fairly limited one-to-one interaction there. And of course, nothing prohibits a psychiatrist from talking about general principles of both medical care and prison administration. If the court has no further questions, just a minute on pseudonymity. So we have an odd scenario.
It seems to me that there's no appellate jurisdiction over the district court's order about proceeding anonymously. This is an appeal of a preliminary injunction, and we have jurisdiction to review the grant of the preliminary injunction, but it seems to me only that and not every other kind of order that's going on here.
I disagree with that, Your Honor. I mean, and I would point to two things. So literally the first two words of the preliminary injunction order are Jane Doe instead of the plaintiff's name. And so I don't know how the pseudonymity order doesn't merge. And again, I'm standing here...
But the proceeding anonymously is something that's for all purposes in the district court. Isn't that right?
Okay, then if I can switch points. In this court, as we sit here today, there is a record.
It seems to be an end run around the jurisdictional problem. And where we owe considerable deference to the district court about whether to proceed anonymously to now... achieve because there's an appeal what you couldn't achieve by virtue of the appeal of the preliminary injunction itself as to what's going on in the district court. That troubles me.
Okay, the last thing I'll say about this, I won't belabor it. The volumes 4 and 5 of the sealed appendix, there are four documents I urge the court to look at. The first, it's a declaration Doe filed in a previous case, publicly available on PACER. There's a complaint Doe filed in 2018 against prison officials, publicly available on PACER, a complaint from 2022, and then a judicial opinion in volume 5 of the sealed appendix. Those four documents name Doe, identify Doe as transgender, demand additional services. As we sit here today in this court, those are under seal, even though they're public documents. And so again, I won't belabor the point. And
I would like to ask you a little bit about this point too. If I understand this right, much of the entire record of the preliminary injunction hearing in this very case remains under seal as we speak now. Do I have that right?
Correct.
Including, among other things, the transcript of the preliminary injunction hearing is sealed.
Correct.
So if we were to rule X or Y and somebody wanted to look at why we did what we did, they would have no access to the actual hearing conducted by the district court, correct?
Correct.
And I take it they would have no access to any of the prior complaints in the past lawsuits? Those have been sealed up.
They would have access because they're public documents, which is why
but we've sealed them.
Yes.
Or at least they remain sealed in this courtroom. The medical examinations that were done for this case remain under seal here, correct?
The expert reports are public, but many of the underlying documents are sealed, yes.
I meant doctor went out, examined the patient, wrote notes, reached conclusions, that's all sealed
yes.
up. And other legal filings which might otherwise reveal the name. Let me ask the question this way. Is it not possible to keep the name under seal, redact that, from the rest of the record and make it part of the public record so that if John Q. Public wants to walk in here and understand what's going on and why, there's a record to be reviewed? Or will he simply have to rely on our good faith in the order we enter?
We certainly wouldn't oppose that. Again, we think any of the sealing was inappropriate. And again, within the prison, everyone in the prison knows who the plaintiff is and that the plaintiff is going through a felony.
I appreciate that. I don't think I've made my question clear. Isn't it possible to disgorge the whole record and still keep the name secret?
Of course.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, counsel. We'll hear from opposing counsel now, Counsel Dangoran.
Good morning, Your Honors. D. Dangoran for the plaintiff appellee. May it please the court. I'd like to make three main points, and I'll just pick up right where you left off, Judge Marcus. The district court does, as Chief Judge Pryor said, lack jurisdiction over the appeal of the issue, and it is an end run to go through the motion and do the same analysis. And so the name, as well as the medical history, the sensitive medical information, was what the district court based its ruling on in the pseudonym order. So even if you redacted the name, the actual medical information is also meant to be under seal, and the district court actually has entered an order that at the end of proceedings, the parties are to meet and confer and decide what can be unsealed. And so, you know, though immediately after this appeal, the transcript may not be available, perhaps that is one way that we can move forward in the future to redact the name. But to
there are cases in which you can seal medical records. I'm sorry. There are cases in which you can seal medical records to protect the identity of the person to whom those records belong, and yet not seal the transcript of an entire hearing completely. Mm-hmm. And so that you can partially redact. I'm not saying that's appropriate here. I haven't done that analysis, but I'm saying complete sealing is not always necessary or the answer.
I understand, Your Honor, and that's been the approach that the district court has made in many of the other filings, leaving it to the parties to decide what to seal or redact. It is not the case that the entire record is under seal, and there are some redacted versions. I'm actually not certain if the entire transcript is under seal.
Your colleague said the preliminary injunction transcript is under seal. Is that correct?
He did say that. I don't know the answer right now, Your Honor, so
Let me ask just one quick question on this pseudonymity, and then we go on to, let's call it, the main event. But as to the pseudonymity issue, did not the plaintiff disgorge essentially all of this terribly personal and tragic information into the public record in lawsuits that were filed, disgorged A, being gender dysphoric, B, various problems that arose from that, including several suicide attempts and several attempts, sad tales of inflicting harm? Isn't that all in the public record anyway? And if that is the case, why should all of this remain under seal? I agree with you that we don't have the authority to review the district court opinion, but we most assuredly have control over our own docket and what's filed in our court and what's kept secret and what isn't. So I want you to tell me why, in your view, all of this stuff having been publicly disgorged in other lawsuits at other times, there's any reason to keep it sealed up in this courtroom at this time for this review of this preliminary injunction order.
Yes, Your Honor. So first, Ms. Doe did not have the benefit of counsel in the past and maybe did not realize she could have pursued her litigation under a pseudonym, and what she did in the past should not dictate what can happen here. But more to the point, in this current political climate, transgender people are at risk of very specific forms of abuse. She's actually received a letter recently. This is outside of the record, but to answer Your Honor's question, she received a letter from someone she does not know saying they're watching her case and they're aware of who she is, and she was very horrified by that. And so there is a fear that with the details of what she has put forth and the fact that she has succeeded in getting some preliminary injunctive relief, that could upset people, and that if they knew her name and knew the care that she's received recently, but also knew the specific things that happened after her last public filing in the year 2023, none of that was on the record in any of her previous filings. So there is actually new information.
So is it practicable to ask at least my last question in this area for this court to leave it to counsel to tell us what has to be sealed up to secure the name and nothing else?
Your Honor, I think that could be a fair resolution, yes. So,
isn't that the wisest way to proceed here?
Well, Your Honor, if it's the decision...
You accept the importance of a public record in a court of appeals.
I certainly do, Your Honor, and I think the public record is very much available in the public filings already. The briefs are publicly filed.
Right, but the transcript of the very hearing is not.
Your Honor, if the transcript is what needs to be redacted for the name, I agree. I think that sensitive medical information did not all make it to that transcript.
Okay.
But yes, I'd like to move now to Cohane, and I believe from listening to the oral arguments, it's pronounced Ms. Cohane. So Cohane does not require this court to overturn the district court's injunction. In Cohane, this court found the plaintiff's hair length and makeup requests were not medically necessary.
It seems to me the district court just engaged in blatantly erroneous reasoning and concluding that because your client was receiving this more sophisticated care, that it was somehow an Eighth Amendment violation to not provide the less sophisticated care that is the subject of this appeal. Why am I not right about that?
Yeah, I hear you, Chief Judge Pryor. There's a very specific way to move forward here that I actually disagree with the way you framed it as less sophisticated.
I'm just reading the order.
Yes. So there is a clear agreement from the parties that there's a serious medical need. That's the first legal question, right? That there's a serious medical need, and that is gender dysphoria.
And that there's a provision of care for that need.
So the provision of care that is medically necessary is feminization. And the effect of feminization is what our client was able to achieve, receiving the correct amount of care from 2015 to 2019. She experienced breast growth and reduction of body hair. That is how
a constitutional violation, though it has to be so grossly incompetent, inadequate, or excessive as to shock the conscience. And it's not that the prison's not providing some treatment. The prison is.
Well, Your Honor,
and the district court concluded that because it was providing that treatment, it was somehow also required under the Eighth Amendment to provide the treatment that we're talking about here. I don't understand that.
Yes, Your Honor, I'd like to explain it to you. So actually, UNCADA says that there's a constitutionally adequate, that's the level, a minimally adequate care is the standard. And so the question at hand is whether the care she was receiving was minimally adequate. And so what plaintiff is arguing and what
the district court reasoned that it was not because there was this provision of more sophisticated care. That's what the district court said.
It's not more sophisticated care, Your Honor. It really is.
But certainly more expensive, would you agree?
No, I actually don't know if the provisions provided just now is more expensive than some forms of care our client could receive. But I think that the key point is that the effectiveness of the care currently provided, Your Honor, is not creating the feminization effects. And Dr. Malloy, her endocrinologist from the GDC, actually conceded to her directly, and this is on the record, that she will not receive the feminizing effects on the dosage he prescribed her, that it would need to be a higher level. And so that's the real issue.
Yeah, but, you know, the treatment that is being provided is not the one that provides the same kind of security concerns that the treatment that's not being provided does. And it seems to me not to be grossly incompetent on the part of the prison and a constitutional violation to strike the balance that way.
So, Your Honor, again, there's a difference between the medically necessary care and the constitutional element. I'll get to the constitutional element, but I just want to make sure for medically necessary care first, because that's separate from the security risk rationale, which I will also turn to. The medically necessary care, our friend on the other side has tried to downplay it by saying that it's a low bar and that that's what our expert stated. But actually, medically necessary care, as defined by the Medicare statute, is medical care or services needed to diagnose or treat an illness, injury, condition, disease, or its symptoms that meets accepted standards of medicine. And so this court would need to overturn the district court's finding of fact that there was a...
The district court also made that finding based on an erroneous understanding of the record. I mean, just totally... It said that the warden didn't address the security concerns when, in fact, the warden did.
Your Honor, again, the security concern is separate from the medically necessary care, but I can turn to security concerns briefly.
Before you get to security, if I...
Go ahead, go ahead.
While we're talking about this issue, do we not have evidence in the record, substantial body of evidence in the record, that flatly disputes the proposition that these items are medically necessary? We have a report by Levine, and in the report he says, so social transitioning items are not medically necessary. They might be, quote, psychologically helpful, but they're not medically necessary. Then we had a report from a testimony to that effect. And then we had a report by Khalib in this area, basically saying the same thing. And of course, we've got obviously competent and capable psychiatrists on the plaintiff's side who say it's not only medically necessary, it's medically imperative, I think is the phrase that one of them uses. But don't we have the very collision that the circuit considered earlier in Kiohan, the case that Mr. Harris made reference to, that you've got pulls in opposite directions on this question, and that if you do, whatever else you can say, maybe you could say it's negligent conduct, but in no sense could that amount to care that's so grossly incompetent, inadequate, or excessive as to shock the conscience or to be intolerable to fundamental fairness. That the very nature of the dispute from competent and warring experts renders the Eighth Amendment claim nugatory, because you can't meet the high standard. The Chief Judge made reference to that for you. How do you get around the fact that there's contrary evidence here? A substantial body from two psychiatric experts, and no one's saying that they're not competent to opine in the field.
So, Your Honor, multiple ways. So first, as I think Your Honor acknowledged already, Dr. Levine and Dr. Khalib did not evaluate our plaintiff. The call from the Eighth Amendment is for an individualized medical assessment. And for that reason, there's actually no dispute between any of the medical providers who's actually met with our client and the experts on the record.
But you would agree, I offered this example to Mr. Harris a moment ago, if an endocrinologist offered the opinion that you had to give insulin to a patient who was plainly type 2 diabetic, or maybe even more type 1 diabetic, and the failure to do that would be plainly a violation of the lowest standard of care that you would have to do, he wouldn't have to actually see the plaintiff to do that. He could render, and we get forensic opinions all the time from doctors who don't see the party, but they rely upon a sufficient body of competent evidence.
That sounds like, to me, Your Honor, like trying to establish what exactly the medical standard of care is. And that's very different from applying that standard of care to the actual plaintiff involved. Dr. Levine actually stated, and this is at plaintiff's supplemental appendix.
I think what he's doing is, if we assume, for the sake of the argument, that this person has this condition, then you would have to, at a minimum, provide this care. Why can't you also assume that the person who suffers from gender dysphoria has to be provided the cross hormone treatment, but not these other things that would be psychologically pleasing and that pose legitimate prison concerns, and the experts for the state actually have correctional experience and know about the balancing of risk here?
Your Honor, because that's the precise type of blanket ban or classification-based denial of types of care that Cohen rejected. Dr. Levine actually here, though, did not state that social affirming items would never be permissible. At Plaintiff Supplemental Appendix 259, there's a quote from Levine's declaration, paragraph 7, where he says social treatments are a recommended treatment for preventing suicide. And so here, our client has exhibited so many types of suicidal and self-castrative behaviors and self-injurious behaviors that the care that she needs is the feminizing effect of gender-affirming care. That hormone therapy did not take place.
Running out of time, so can I?
Yes, I am, Your Honor.
Can I ask you to address what I think is a problem for you in this case, and that is that whatever Keohane stands for, read narrowly, broadly, it certainly says that you have got to take into account and seriously consider the concern of prison officials about safety and security when dealing with providing these sorts of things. I know that the items in Keohane were different than the items here. I understand that factual difference. But here, the district court's order seems to have, these are my words, ignored the warden's affidavit with regards to the safety and security concerns that he thought were created by the provision of these items. So what's your response?
Your Honor, the first response is the warden did state elements about escape and enticing others, which are similar to those in Keohane, which was specifically the enticing others. But this court did do the proper weighing of the medical need with the security risk rationale. And I think one element to that, you know, and it's clear, and I put it in my briefs where exactly that is, but the warden knew about the use of makeshift padding. And that's something that at footnote 8
I'm not saying that the district court would have been stuck with the warden's view about safety and security. There may be a case out there where a safety or security concern is so outlandish, so improbable, that a district court can weigh it relatively lightly. But here, the district court didn't really, in my opinion, take into account the warden's affidavit. It didn't say, I hear what you're saying. As a fact finder, I discount it for these reasons. It just didn't seem to think that there was any testimony from the warden about safety and security with regard to these items. Am I mistaken?
No, I agree, Your Honor, and that's why we made the harmlessness inquiry. But again, the warden's statements about makeshift...
But it's hard to argue harmlessness when the fact finder is the one who doesn't take into account significant evidence, probative evidence.
Well, under the clear error standard and the actual use here, I do think that would be relevant, right? I think that the finding of fact made, there were multiple findings of fact, but the one made here was that, and it's a finding of fact, that there's not a security risk that overcomes the medical need.
Here's the problem, at least from my perspective, and I really would appreciate your helping me with it. One, I begin with the statute, the very preface in the Prison Litigation Reform Act. The very first paragraph talks about narrowing and all this. And then it says, quote, the court shall, not may, shall give substantial weight to any adverse impact on public safety or the operation of the criminal justice system caused by the relief. The case law all says that, but Congress very specifically wanted to send a message to the federal courts when they wrote that Prison Litigation Reform Act and put that language in. Now, if you look at the judge's order, the preliminary injunction order, he says, among other things, on page 24, this is the hard copy of his opinion, defendants didn't really raise a security concern over padding. One of the defendant's psychiatry experts opined, blah, 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 but even putting aside the court's doubts regarding the expert's qualifications to testify about issues of prison security, defendants did not mention the concern in their brief. And then we get to the critical sentence I want you to help me with. Quote, defendants presented affidavits from two people who work at prisons, paren Warden Jones and Ahmed Holt, but neither of them averred that providing plaintiffs padding would pose a security concern. That's flat out wrong. It not only ignores it, it misstates the record. And my question to you is, how could we say that the district court gave substantial weight to any adverse impact on public safety if it fails to even recognize that there is some competent testimony from the warden of this very prison that providing the padding would in fact impact on the public safety? Isn't this right off the bat clear error?
I agree, Your Honor, that there is a complete misstatement there. The following sentences on page 25 are where I would direct Your Honor to read next, because the court did discuss the possibility of the risk. And by assessing the fact that Warden Jones allowed the use of the makeshift padding, this is the same thing that would have, if the court actually in the statement before had said the correct thing, it would have been weighing what actually happened and the evidence on the record of what happened with this testimony made for trial. And it's important that it was made in Johnson versus Lewis from this court. If the reasons are produced for litigation, that's relevant. And so I do think that what actually happened versus what was produced for litigation would be the way that we'd resolve that.
We would need to rely upon, and it's basically a harmless error argument, right?
Yes, Your Honor, it is. I just want to ensure that there's, I just want to make sure that this court understands my medical necessity argument, but I know I'm way over time.
Way over. And let's get it. I'll give you 15 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor. The care provided will eventually take place with the hormone therapy provided. Your Honor has framed that as a sophistication difference, but it really is what the need narrowness inquiry of PLRA requires. To keep our client safe and alive, okay, until the HRT takes effect, this care is necessary. For that reason, you should affirm.
I think we understand, counsel. Counsel Harris?
Thank you, Your Honor. Just a couple of very quick points in rebuttal. So first of all, my friend quoted the definition of medical necessity from the Medicare statute, which again, of course, is not the Eighth Amendment statute. The Medicare statute does not say care need not be perfect or adequate or even very good. It just need not be grossly incompetent. So once again, that's not the definition we're doing under the Eighth Amendment. The second point, on this question, the district court seemed to use this syllogism, which my friend said as well, of since the hormones may have a feminizing effect, why wouldn't you just do the other items too? That is almost verbatim an argument that was raised unsuccessfully in Keohane. So the plaintiff's expert in Keohane, this is page 1264, said it would be medically and logically inconsistent and potentially harmful to do the hormone treatment. Because remember, the plaintiff in Keohane was getting hormones, just like our plaintiff, and yet the court still said it wasn't constitutionally obligated to do the other item. So the same argument was made there and it didn't work. The third quick point, my friend mentioned the suicide risk. The prison takes that incredibly seriously and acts every day to protect plaintiff and all other inmates from harm to themselves or others. But the First Circuit explained this very eloquently in Kosolek, the en banc opinion, which said it cannot be that prison officials must, in response to a threat of suicide, simply give the inmate whatever is demanded, because that creates terrible incentives for order. So we take this incredibly seriously. And again, the prisoner is a level 3 mental health offender who has several comorbid conditions in addition to this. And that results in extra monitoring, extra care, extra services. So we take that incredibly seriously.
On the anonymity, do you agree with what Judge Marcus has proposed about unsealing the hearing transcript subject to redaction of the name?
I don't agree with the second part, but we'd be happy to do that. And I just said that I'm not certain about that. It's in the sealed appendix in this court, which is what I base my answer off of. But
I understand. Let me ask you just an overarching question that troubled me from the beginning when I started to look at it. I know we have to defer or give reasonable consideration to prison officials who say there are powerful security problems here, and I know that Jane Doe has attempted escape, attempted mailing a bomb, a variety of very serious security issues. But everybody agrees she's gender dysphoric, and the prison agrees that she's entitled to treatment. And among the treatments that they've offered is this hormone replacement therapy, which would make her look more feminine. So you're going to do the very thing that you suggest will create a big security risk. The warden says, in substance, and your psychiatric experts say more or less the same thing, if she's given this padding and this hair cream removal, it will enable her to look more feminine. The warden says if you do that, that's going to run right smack into this powerful security problem. And yet you're actually going down the road that creates that very security problem. What am I missing here?
A couple quick points, if I may. So the first thing is that's exactly, that was true in Keohane as well.
And then, oh, I understand that.
And then, of course, the padding, there is a difference in between giving an inmate something to physically put in their clothes, which obviously poses contraband risk. And then the last thing I'll say, we address this at 22 to 23 of our opening brief. There's another security concern, which is it is imperative in a prison to have uniform rules. And for example, the hair removal cream, when an inmate gets what looks like special access to something or an item that's not otherwise available, it creates questions of fairness or retribution.
No, I accept all of that. But by going forward with the hormone treatment, don't you create the very problem you say you have to avoid and therefore or not to provide the padding?
Our officials have decided that the padding does pose unique concerns, and we believe that was entitled to deference, to concerns beyond changes to the body.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We're going to move to the last case.